Welcome to Calvary Church, where we are dedicated to loving God and loving people. If you want to know more about us, please check us out online at calvary.ca. Now let's check out this week's message.
Let me take you back to earlier this morning. Here's my prayer. Dear God, so far today I've done all right. I haven't gossiped, lost my temper, been greedy or grumpy, been nasty, selfish or overindulgent, and I'm very thankful for that. But in a few minutes, God, I'm going to get out of bed, and from then on, I'm probably going to need a lot more help. Isn't that really true about all of us? We need a lot of help to get through a day, a week, a month, a year, in fact, our entire life. Now, I've had the privilege of writing a number of books, and my most recent book is titled Under the Influence. Now, that wasn't its first title. The working title was called What's Your Story? And it was based on everything that happens to us is a story. Where we were born, where we lived, where was our first high school, where were some of our experiences, what meaningful experiences happened to us growing up, who and what impacted us at an early stage, who were our best friends, who did we marry, what and who affected us the most. You see, because your life is unique, just as you are. There are no two people just the same. Now, the stories of our life have affected us tremendously. They have shaped our lives, both good and bad. And as my writing continued with my stories, I modified the title to Influence. And then finally, towards the end of the book, I called the book Under the Influence, believing that our life stories and experiences that have a profound effect and influence on who we have become. Now, over the years, it's been an honor for me to speak about 5,000 times. And my very first speech was grade 9 graduation, Massey Theater in New Westminster, and I fell in love with speaking. And it's been an honor to have spoken on 5 continents, all over the world. The people I've met and interacted with have influenced me both good and bad. Albert Einstein said this, setting an example is not the main means of influence others, it is the only means. Paul said this, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1. Now, on my 75th birthday, my 3 girls, Samantha, Rebecca, and Amanda, along with their husbands, took my wife Kay and I for an elaborate dinner at one of Vancouver's most prestigious restaurants called Bacchus, which you probably know is downtown Vancouver in the Wedgwood Hotel. And we were surrounded by the most important people in both of our lives. I was exactly where I wanted to be, so the dinner could have been anywhere, but I'm not complaining because, as you can tell, I probably love good food. It was a round table of 8, and it was perfect. We shared many stories and laughs together as we recounted some of the highs and lows over the years, including some of my most embarrassing and unfortunate business mistakes and failures. With the whole family together, the evening was all about having fun, and for me, there is nothing greater or more important than that. Now, as I read the special wishes in my birthday cards, I was touched by my family's kind, loving words, which I felt undeserving of. For in my mind, I had often wondered if I had really done a good enough job as a father, a husband, an influencer to my precious family, influencing them in a positive way to be the best they can be and help them to the best of my ability. Author John Addison's quote from his book, Real Leadership, says, people don't follow what you say, they follow what you do. Leadership guru John Maxwell said, leadership is all about influence. And so for each one of us, our influence must first be in the home. And while Kay and I know we are far from perfect parents, we are both so proud of our daughters and their husbands. In our influence to influence others, in a significant way for their benefit, we might wonder at times who is really watching. And you might be surprised by the answer, because the average person directly or indirectly influences 10,000 other people during a typical lifetime. And those in a position of leadership influence many, many more. Remember this, your reputation enters the room before you do. Now, since I was a small boy, I've been accustomed to traveling and taking on new journeys. I embarked on my first significant journey just 5 days before my fifth birthday, when my parents sent me away to Tavistoll Preparatory School in Sussex. As proper English parents, my mom and dad believed it was important for me to have the right kind of influences in my life. As I stepped off the train into a life of rules, order, and discipline, my world was transformed forever. 7 years later, my entire world changed once more when my parents decided to emigrate to Canada and we headed off together on a new adventure. Then I was 12 years old. 12 years old. We arrived in New Westminster, and I quickly took on the moniker of the English boy at the Vincent Massey Junior High School, then graduated to Pearson High School, now called New Westminster Secondary School, and the experiences and influences I encountered at both schools, Tavistock Hall in England, had a significant impact on me during my formative years. Now, I'm not sure if I was just part of the nature of my behavior, but I endeavored to make the most of my journeys and experience everything that was available to me. I also enjoyed sharing stories of my adventures, no matter if they were big or small. And over the years, they have not only formed my life, they have been a significant part of my 5,000 speeches. I've also written 25 books, and I've authored more things than I would like to have said I did, but I've learned by sharing my experiences is what people love to hear stories. It's part of how we connect with one another and how we create community. It is also how we learn and develop as individuals. Now, not all stories have a happy ending. That's life. Some will be stories of failure, of loss, of grief, of rejection, of despair. But those, too, have great value because they are the ones that make us stronger, teach us how to love and to help and become wiser. They prepare us for the challenges that lead to bigger and better stories yet to come. Now, my new book is a collection of the stories I put together in the last 75 years of my journey. Stories of my experiences, both happy and sad. Relationships that have grown. Roads traveled, risks taken, aspirations achieved, problems conquered, rejections, recognition, successes, and failures. All of which I believe have made me wiser and better as a human being. And the best part about these stories of my life, good or bad, they're like old friends, and I enjoy their company immensely. Now, I believe each of us are all born with the seeds of greatness within us. But those seeds can only grow if we nurture them, if we are aware of those seeds and take action and develop them. Do you know what brings purpose and meaning to your life? How did you become the person you are today? What influences you have invited to your life? How will those influences shape the person you become tomorrow? Are you consciously deciding how to live your life? One of the most recent books I've read is a biography on Paul by Nicholas Thomas Wright, the former Bishop of Durham in the Church of England, and one of the world's leading New Testament Bible scholars. The book is about St. Paul the Apostle, and you may have heard someone or something in their life as the road to Damascus. It's a road to Damascus experience, which refers to a sudden turning point in one's life. The term is in reference to St. Paul's conversion to Christianity when he was traveling along the road from Jerusalem to Damascus. And prior to that moment, he had been a Pharisee who persecuted the followers of Jesus. A road to Damascus moment is a sudden transformation in a personal belief or character, which might be religious or it might not be. Almost every one of us, at one time or another, have eventually had our own Damascus Road experience. Perhaps it was a result of a tragedy. Perhaps it was because of a bad habit that causes us to finally decide, I can't live like this. Maybe it was a breakup. Maybe it was a divorce. Maybe it was an accident. Maybe, like Paul, you encountered God for the first time. When I was 16 years old, when my dad, pardon me, was 16 years old, seeing very little in the way of prospects for himself in Wales, my father came home from school in Barry, South Wales, and he said to his mother, I'm going to run away to sea. Her answer was, have a good time. My dad's nickname was Bernie, quickly procured a job as a cabin boy, and the first ship he sailed on was called Vancouver City. Vancouver City was named after British explorer Captain George Vancouver and owned by the Smith Shipping Line. It was a 9,000-ton freighter that transported iron ore, and while he circumnavigated the globe many times, he also came to Vancouver 6 or 7 times, which was to play a significant role in the Legge family. Now, I never did find out how my father wooed my mother or how he proposed, but my parents married in Greenford, Middlesex in 1937 and moved into a flat at No. 7 Brookfield Court. I was born a short few years later on a cold, blustery January day in 1942. World War II was still going on at this time, and my parents were concerned that the bombing of London might continue, so for safety reasons, they bundled me off to Barry, South Wales, which is 7 miles from Cardiff, to be cared for by my two favorite aunts, my Aunt Bet and my Aunt Bun. And the purpose of sharing this story is to give you some idea of my connection with Wales. My only immediate cousins still live in South Wales, so when Kay and I go to the old country, it always includes a visit to Cardiff. In fact, one of my cousin's daughters is on a 2-year work visa in journalism and works with us at Canada-wide Media. So let's begin with influence. How about the influence of strangers? My first British passport was D919A58, and it admitted me as an immigrant at the Canadian Pacific Highway crossing on March 30th, 1954. I was just 12 years old, and it was the beginning of my Canadian adventure. My mother and I had sailed from Southampton to New York, and after a couple of nights in the Big Apple, we took a Greyhound bus from New York across the United States through Chicago, and our last stop before arriving in New Westminster was Seattle, Washington. My mother took me to the coffee shop in the Greyhound bus depot in Seattle, and for a short break, about 3 or 4 hour ride before we got to our final destination in New Westminster, she said to me, would you like something to eat? And I said, yes, I would. And it didn't occur to me that my mother had no money. It didn't occur to me, how was she going to pay for that meal? I ordered French fries and a Coke and chips. The first thing I've ever eaten in Canada and the United States. Thankfully, a kind lady sitting next to my mother seemed to sense that my mother had no money. And a very kindly lady offered to pay for the meal, which is in those days was far less than $5. And throughout my life, I've often thought of that nameless woman and her kindness towards two people she had never met. And very shortly after she paid for the meal, she quietly slipped out of her seat and disappeared. As one of the very first encounters in this new world, it made me think, and it made me have a lasting impression on me. I remember wondering, is this what they mean to be kind to strangers? And very often, it's not the size of the gift that matters, but the awareness that someone is in need and there is something that you can do to help. Acts 20, verse 35, Jesus said, "It is more blessed to give than receive." That act of generosity was my first North American teaching point, and I've never forgotten it. Sometimes the simplest gifts can last a lifetime. And I'm sure this story has influenced me many, many times, and it has also encouraged me to be as generous as I can. Over the years, it inspired me to help many, many organizations right here in Canada raise millions and millions of dollars for very worthy causes. And perhaps it all started with a hamburger, a fries, and a Coke. I spent nearly my entire working life in the media business, radio, TV, print, and it has served me well. It's an ever-changing business that takes no prisoners, requires enormous stamina and creativity to sustain success in an industry for the past 45 years, and it is not for the faint of heart. I've also been blessed with a long career in speaking, trying to inspire others to reach their dreams. And whether it's in my office or a speaking engagement, there's not a week goes by where someone doesn't ask me how I started the company. How did I start TV Week magazine, which, as many of you might know, was my first foray into the publication business? What challenges did I face in those early years, and how difficult was it to become so successful? Most beginnings aren't very sexy or necessarily easy, and my story is no different in that regard. You probably have a similar story. It started with failure. I suppose I could have been viewed as a bad thing. But what if we talk, as we talked about in the first chapter of this book, a failure such as losing your job presents you with the opportunity to follow a lifelong dream? What if it wakes up the fact that you really didn't like that job anyway? What if it helps you realize you were just marking time because you were scared to take a leap of faith and make a change? What then? I believe that most of us are far more afraid of failure than we need to be. Failure is a wonderful tool that acts like an alarm call, helping us to realize that we need to make adjustments in our plan or ditch the plan altogether and make a new one. As long as you are willing to keep going and keep trying new things, we aren't failing, we're learning. In my own life, it took getting fired to finally motivate me to fill a long-standing dream to own my own business. So how did it happen? In the summer of 1976, Joe Chesney was an on-air personality at New Westminster CKNW radio station on Columbia Street. Joe and a group of investors applied for a national radio license, got it, in the city of Langley. They called the station CJJC, and it was the only AM radio station in the Langley area at that time. As the station was being established in the market, Joe realized he needed a competitive sales department to compete with the biggest stations in Vancouver because he needed the advertising dollars. And so he offered me the position of general sales manager with the station. I jumped at the opportunity. And because of my media connections throughout the Lower Mainland, he thought it would be an asset for that station. Although Joe and I had certain philosophical differences, he was very encouraged by my sales approach. In pretty short order, our revenue exceeded the station's budget, and we were on our way. Now, as the station became more established, Joe pretty much left the sales department to me as he tended to his on-air duties, in addition to running the business and building the community presence. However, as the station grew in prominence and profitability, the relationship between Joe and me did not. On a Thursday morning, just before noon, and we never seemed to forget these little details, there was a short memo that went to the staff, and here's what it said. Peter Legg is no longer employed by this radio station. It will be business as usual. Business as usual. Maybe for the station, but certainly not for me. Now, I'm not the first person to be fired, but for me, it was the first time, and I vowed right then and then it would be the last time. As with anyone who's ever been fired, I wondered what had happened. I thought I'd done a pretty good job handling the sales department, competing with the bigger Vancouver radio market, expanding and exceeding budgets every month, and getting the station recognized far beyond our broadcast borders. For 3 years, we even scooped up the World Hockey Association broadcast rights and sold it out. Now, I know Joe and I had philosophical differences, but I resented and strongly disagreed with many of his things, and so he terminated me. It was his station, and he had every right to decide who would work for him and who wouldn't. Clearly, I didn't fit his plans. Now, in those days, it was a 45-minute drive from the station to my home in Coquitlam. And I'd have to drive home and break the news to Kay. I had no idea how she would respond. When I told her there would be no more commissions, no more severance pay, how was she going to respond to me? I'm not a particularly fast driver, and this was before the age of cell phones, so I had a lot of time to think on my way home. And when I got home, I was nervous. I parked the car. I prepared to face the music. How would Kay react? What would she say? Would she get mad? Would she blame me for not being a good provider? Would she leave me? My mind was racing. I opened the back door and walked in, and Kay said, "You're home early. How'd your day go today?" I said, "Well, let's have a glass of wine and chat." As we sat down, Kay knew something was up, and she said, "Okay, what is it?" I bit my tongue, and I said, "I got fired earlier today. I no longer have a job. Holding my breath, I waited for her reaction, expecting her to be upset or angry. 5 long minutes, not a word. And then Kay said, "Good. You shouldn't be working with someone else anyway. You should be working for yourself. You're smart, you're creative, and you're the best salesman in town. Maybe it's time to get into your own business." The power of words. The power of words. Wow. Talk about support. Talk about encouragement. While I was still in shock, I hadn't considered this might be a good thing. And over the next several days, Kay's words echoed throughout my mind. Sometimes, quite often, what seems like a terrible thing like being fired can actually change your life. It certainly changed mine. Kay influenced my decision-making. My departure from the station was the catalyst for actions that set me on a course of daring and courageous decisions, some of the biggest I've ever made. I had a wife and a child of support. I was heavily in debt. My house was mortgaged to the hilt. I had cashed in all my life insurance to buy 10% of the station, and now I was on the street with no notice, no golden handshake, no termination pay, absolutely nothing, but a lady who loved me. The circumstances I found myself in reminded me of the story of Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon in 49 BC. Now, the Rubicon is a shallow river that in Caesar's time acted as a northern boundary of Italy, and as the governor of a northern territory whose governorship was about to expire, the Roman Senate instructed Caesar to disband his army and return to Rome. Caesar was explicitly ordered not to march his army across the Rubicon and into Rome. If to do so, it would be an act of treason and a declaration of war against the Roman Senate. Caesar is reported to have said, "The die is cast. The die is cast." As he led his army across the shallow river, thus declaring war on the Roman Empire. Today, that phrase is called crossing the Rubicon. It is a metaphor for a fateful decision or passing the point of no return. Despite the fact that I was behind the eight ball financially, I made my own decision to cross the Rubicon when I decided that I would never again work for someone else. Former U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt said this, "Far and away the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing." It was high time I started working for myself and building my own company. Timing is everything. Enter Big Al Davidson. Those of you that lived in Vancouver for the last 50 years would know that Big Al was the most listened to and quoted sports director in Greater Vancouver on the Mighty 98. He had a booming voice, strong opinions, and everyone knew Big Al. He was much better sportscaster than was a businessman, and it didn't take him long before his fledgling publication was in deep financial trouble. As fate would have it, Al declared bankruptcy approximately the same time I got fired. I heard through the grapevine that the magazine's printer had inherited the publication when the printing bill went unpaid, and while I wished to continue printing the magazine, they weren't interested in becoming the publisher. They needed a publisher. When you're down, you need to be bold. I heard about the opportunity and approached the new owners, and a new deal was made, and I ended up buying 50% of the magazine for the unpaid bill of $76,000, and we renamed the publication TV Week Magazine. My first day as publisher was April 3rd, 1976. It was a rented back room in a Vancouver print shop with a staff of 3. We went to work assembling listings, selling advertising, developing editorial material, and seeking a network to circulate the We Try Harder TV listings for a market that really didn't need us. When you have TV Guide, who needs TV Week? At the time, no one expected this humble foray into Canadian publishing would put us in the fast track to success. But God had different plans. God knew what he was doing. God had a purpose for what had just happened in the last few weeks. In our first year, our sales topped 70,000. TV Week took on the giant, and with panache, style, and enthusiasm, we began to beat him at his own game. Our initial success spurred new ventures. We began to gather the beginnings of a great army of enthusiasts who would nurture Canada-wide media and make it the publishing force it is today. Our acquisitions and product development over the past 45 years has made us about a $20 million company with more than 100 media professionals. TV Week has become the highest paid circulated magazine of lifestyle in Canada. And now we own every major magazine in Vancouver, such as BC Business, Vancouver Magazine, Garden Wise, Western Living, BC Home, plus 20 other custom publications. God influenced me. God moved my position. God changed the way I thought and dreamed and acted. Was it easy? No. Has everything we've done been successful? No. But what's being in business all about? It's being able to revel in the successes and sweat through the difficulties, learning from our failures, mistakes, bad decisions, to eventually make the company stronger. Oh yeah, we've had good years, we've had bad years, but now I'm thrilled to say that we own 100% of the business and it's owned by my family. Now looking back, I would never have imagined that I would be influenced to changing paths by losing that job. A job that I'd staked my future on, something that was completely devastating at the time, would lead me to the opportunity that would shape the rest of my life. So if there's one lesson that I could pass on to you today, it would be this. Very often we wait for the right opportunity or the right moment to make a change or embark on a new venture. And we wait, and we wait, and we wait. So whatever you're waiting for, stop waiting. Stop waiting until your car or your home is paid off. Stop waiting until you get in shape or lose 20 pounds. Stop waiting until you have kids or until your kids leave home. Stop waiting until you get married. Stop waiting until you get divorced. Stop waiting until you get retired. Stop waiting. God has given us a period of time to be influenced by others and a period of time to influence others, somewhere between 85 and 90 years old. The characteristics of honesty, integrity, honoring commitments, and personal discipline is so important to our success in life. In Clayton M. Christian's book, How Will You Measure Your Life?, the author explains that when it comes to principles of integrity, it is easier to hold your principles 100% of the time than it is to hold them 98% of the time. Telling yourself it's okay to lie, cheat, or steal just this once. It's a slippery slope. The more often it leads to a place you don't want to end up. A case in point made headlines in the United States when one of Donald Trump's personal lawyers was sentenced to 3 years in prison for tax evasion. What happened to him? He had to pay a $50,000 fine and $1.4 million in restitution and forfeit $500,000 in assets. That's not influence. We live in a country where the majority of people that I would call overprivileged, and logically you would think that would make us endlessly thankful for what we have, especially if we happen to pay attention to what is going on in the rest of the world. Whenever I speak to an audience about how much abundance we have in our life, I always say that we can come up at least with 15 things we are grateful for. When we verbally are grateful for the blessings in our lives, it changes who we are. It changes what we will be. It changes how we look at things. For example, if you woke up this morning with more health than illness, you're more blessed than millions who will not survive this week. If you have never experienced the danger of battle, the agony of torture, or the pangs of starvation, you are more fortunate than 500 million people in the world. If you can attend a religious meeting like you are today, with fear of harassment, torture, or death, you are more blessed than 3 billion people in the world. If you have enough food to eat, clothes on your back, a roof over your head, and a place to sleep, you are richer than 75% of the world. If you have money in the bank, money in your wallet, spare change in a dish someplace, you are among the top 8% of the world's wealthy. If you hold up your head with a smile on your face and are truly thankful, you are blessed because the majority can't, but most choose not to. If you can hold someone's hand, hug them, or even pat them on the shoulder, you are blessed because you can offer a healing touch. Never forget that you are one of the fortunate ones and count your blessings every day. A few months ago, you might remember the story of a boy named Bridger Walker. It took place in Cheyenne, Wyoming. This young boy, Bridger, who was 6 years old, was out for a walk with his younger sister, who was 4 years old. Ephesians 5:1 says, "Therefore be the imitators of God as dear children." Unprovoked, the little boy and his sister were attacked by a vicious dog. Unprovoked. The six-year-old boy immediately came to the defense of his younger sister and protected her from the dog. In the process, he got bitten on the side of his face as he fought off the dog and kept the dog away from his little sister to keep her safe. The little boy was taken to the hospital and received 90 stitches from skilled plastic surgeons. After this event, the little boy's father said to him, "Why did he step in to save his sister?" And the little boy simply said this, "If someone was going to die, I thought it should be me. If someone was going to die, I thought it should be me. If someone was going to die, I thought it should be me." Consider who died for you because he wants to influence you. Because the most influenced book that ever been written, ever, is the Bible, period. If you really want influence in your life, read and study the Bible. And when you read the New Testament and the life sacrifice of Jesus, it will influence you to change your entire life. Every day, your character will grow. Every day, your understanding will grow. Something terrible happens if you don't take action. You know what that is? Nothing. Nothing happens. But everywhere Jesus went, something happened. Everywhere Jesus went, something happened. I love the story in Luke chapter 19. It's a story about chief tax collector of the day. His name was Zacchaeus. And he heard that Jesus was coming to town in Jericho. He was a wealthy tax collector. And he wanted to find out what sort of person Jesus was. Now, Zacchaeus was a very short man. And the crowds to see Jesus, as always, were large. And they prevented them from seeing him. So he ran ahead and climbed into a sycamore tree. He climbed in the sycamore tree, so he was hoping that Jesus would come under that sycamore tree and he would get a better view. Yes, and Jesus was heading down that dusty path. Now, you can imagine how excited and nervous Zacchaeus was as Jesus kept walking down the dusty trail. Jesus got to the spot where Zacchaeus was in the tree. He looked up and he saw Zacchaeus. Now let's pause for a second. Jesus stopped, looked up, and called him by name. You see, Jesus saw the individual, not just the crowd. He said, "Zacchaeus, hurry up and come on down. I must be your guest today." Now, I expect that was the last thing he expected or even wanted. Zacchaeus hurriedly climbed down, and Jesus welcomed him. Jesus knew him by name as he knows you. Jesus could see the individual, just not the crowd. And as you get closer to Jesus, you'll get a good look at yourself. His life was changed as soon as he came face to face with Jesus. He could see God face to face. What do you think he would say? If you could see God face to face, what do you think he would say? It says in John 10, one of my favorite verses of the Bible, "I have come to bring you life in all its fullness." What about an influence? "I have come to bring you life in all of its fullness." Zacchaeus said, "Salvation has come to this house today. I've come to influence you, your family, your lifestyle, your morals, your personality." Proverbs 22:9, "The generous will themselves be blessed, for they share their food with the poor." Now, the key of this message to me is that Jesus knew him by name and called him by name. And when he did, his life was influenced and changed by Jesus. So my question to you is, do you hear Jesus call you by name? And if you do, what is your response? If you do, what is your response? And remember, if someone's going to die, let it be me, so I can save the world and I can save you. That's what Jesus said. It's been a privilege for Kay and I to go together on many foreign speaking gigs. And a number of years ago, we went to Vienna, Austria. A few blocks from our hotel, we visited the Albertina Museum. That's a modern museum mostly dedicated to the famous art of Albrecht Dürer, twin brothers, but it was from a family of 13. Albrecht Dürer was born on May 21st, 1471, in Nuremberg, Germany. But the father, who was already working three jobs to feed and clothe the 13 people, could ill afford to send either of the boys to university. So the two brothers came up with an idea. They would toss a coin, simple coin toss, and the winner of the coin toss would go to the university, and the loser of the coin toss would work in the mines to help pay the other's tuition. Albert went to the salt mines to earn money. Albrecht went to the university. After the 3 years were up, Albert graduated, and the family had a dinner to celebrate. Albert was one end of the table, and Albrecht was at the other end. And towards the end of the meal, Albrecht stood up with a glass of wine in his hand. He looked directly at his brother, and he said, "Now it's my turn to go to the mine, and it's your turn to go to the university." All the heads turned toward Albert, who lifted his hands over his face, and he said, "It is too late for me. It is too late for me. Every finger on both hands has been broken at least once. Arthritis has set in, and I could not even pick up a paintbrush or any fine instrument." With tears coming down his cheeks, again he said, "It is too late for me." One of Albrecht Dürer's famous paintings is titled The Hands. And these are the hands of Albert Dürer, the brother. Gnarled, scarred, broken hands. A world-class painting to remind us what Albrecht did to sacrifice for his brother. Now, Kay and I bought that painting, or sample of the painting, which probably hangs in our home to remind us of the sacrifice, much like that little six-year-old boy. If someone's going to die, then it's got to be me. In Romans it says, while we were yet sinners, died for us. What did Zacchaeus do? He gave four times to the poor. God influenced him in such a dramatic way to become a generous and honorable man committed to what he did. He was not just an influencer, he was transformed. And so my question to you, when you hear Jesus call you by name, what will your answer be? Will you say, "It's too late for me," or will you put on the new clothes of righteousness and begin your life all over again and be influenced by the Master? It is not too late for you. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for dying for us. Thank you so much for revealing your nature. Thank you so much for loving us and caring for us. And you want the very best for us. You want to influence us more than anything else, to be as close to you as we possibly can. So maybe this Sunday, we'll do just that. We'll call you by name. Jesus, come into my life. Help me. Help me and influence me to be a better mother, a better father, a better parent, a better human being. We need it desperately in this challenging times that we live. We love you, Father, because we know you love us first. In your Son's name we pray. Amen.